Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you so much for inviting me and thank you for staying this late. This time I can claim that I am actually the one standing between the conference and dinner, so that's why I will not show much, indeed, no Greek letters whatsoever, so it will be purely empirical presentation. So since it's a CEPR College de France joint conference, since there is European flavor at the conference, I want to also give a more Europe-oriented talk. And I've been working on Germany for quite some time, we had a fantastic team spending a lot of time digging into the German archives for years and years. So that's why I thought maybe a summary of what we have found through that research could be a good ending to the day. So this was taken at the museum. Indeed, Leipzig has amazing museum from the early 90s, and so this was one of those. So we have quite a few studies. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I would like to just, give you the gist or big picture idea behind those studies. So of course, we are very much motivated by the idea of creative destruction. So and what we are doing is we are trying to understand the German transition through the theory of creative destruction. Of course, there has been enormous amount of work behind creative destruction. I don't need to tell you about it. But, two things that I would like to particularly highlight is that, of course, the book that we edited with John has been, quite important for also for our thinking. But also the Middle Income Trap Report by the World Bank 2024 has put the idea of creative destruction at the center stage, trying to understand the regional development or developing country performance. So that's why the idea of creative destruction has been extremely influential also for understanding developing countries and policy making in those countries as well. So what I'm going to argue today is, first, I will try to argue that in general in Europe, but specifically in Germany, one of the main problems is the lack of sustained productivity growth. And then I think this is going to be very complementary to many of the talks that we had today, especially also to John's talk this morning. So I will argue that indeed we should not just be thinking about creating new ideas, but we should also think about how to use the resources in a better way. And there, I think the performance of the German economy in general is significantly worse compared to the US economy. It's not only about creating new ideas, but once you have the ideas, what to make with those ideas is another important challenge. And I think there's less attention, and there I think there's a bigger gap. And then, of course, how to fix the resource allocation. One can think in many different ways, but one important aspect is the place-based policies, of course. Especially if you think about Europe, of course, Europe has different centers, many different countries, many different centers, and as a result, a lot of things are determined at the local levels. And I think it's important to think about, how to improve the welfare overall also through the place-based policies. And one important aspect, which I think is very much missed, and that's been my experience with, through the conversations with various parties, including policymakers, there's a lot of emphasis on economic growth, but, typically, whatever the source of the growth has the same implication. If it's through capital accumulation versus if it's through productivity growth, or if it's through just, more job creation through, additional subsidies, people seem to be reacting the same way to overall improvement. But actually, what I will argue is that, indeed, many of those induced policies are generating induced growth, and, most of the time they're just creating policy addict firms. And once you remove the policies back, everything goes back. So as a result, yes, policy could be important, but we should always keep in mind that these policies should be temporary at best to jumpstart the engine. Otherwise, you know, we are just creating, you know, policy dependent economy. And then ultimately, you know, I would like to also argue that, you know, there is an important aspect that we are also it's receiving less attention, which is, yes, you know, when it comes to innovation and R&D, new idea generation, it is important, of course, how much time and effort firms and individuals are spending. But at the same time, there's an important capability aspect of it. You know, if, even if people are spending, you know, 24 hours thinking about new ideas, if they are not capable, then, you know, we have the wrong people doing the wrong things. So that's why, you know, the building the capability aspect, some of it can be changed, of course, especially if you think about the region. Some of the capability aspects can change, but we should always keep in mind that there's an underlying capability that has to be also discussed. So these will be the items that I will be going through, you know, during the time that's allocated. So let me now go into the details. So whenever we talk about, you know, cross-country performance, Korea and Poland more recently are always given as the, you know, success stories. So let's start with the Korean growth decomposition. So when we look at the Korean growth, of course, there has been a miracle and, you know, a long-term sustained, you know, reasonably sustained growth. But what's really important here is that dark blue bars, which are the capital growth coming through capital growth, and light blue coming from labor growth, they are usually positive. There's no surprise there. But I think the magical part here is that the red bars are always on the positive side and in a significant way, especially during the fast growth episodes. So Poland, you know, different continent, different time episode, coming from completely different system. Again, we see a similar pattern, basically. You know, when we look at the Polish economy, how it performs, there's a significant improvement also in terms of efficiency in general. So now I would like to switch gears and turn to the German economy. When we look at the German economy, it goes up and down. You know, especially when we look at the productivity growth component, indeed, almost 50% of the years we observe, or you know, one third for sure, but you know, depending on also whichever European country we are looking at, this sustained growth is not the way we observe it in Poland or in Korea. So there's a lot of fluctuations when it comes to productivity growth, and this part is, of course, you know, for many people in this room, it's bread and butter for us, of course. But, you know, explaining this, you know, the source of missing growth, which is due to this productivity growth efficiency, is very challenging. Partly because, of course, you know, what is efficiency, right? You know, you cannot really hold it in your hand. You cannot see it. It's a concept that's very hard to communicate. And that's why typically, you know, when we look at policymakers' decisions, typically building roads and hospitals, etc., it's a, you know, much much more preferred route. So now in that report that I showed in the beginning, 2024 report, that built a lot on ideas that Philip and Peter has developed, but this one particularly was coming from the AAZ paper, where, you know, we tried to describe how an economy starting from a very low income all the way to high income should be evolving. And of course, you know, when we think about a very low income economy, there, you know, even the basic infrastructure is very much needed. And that's why, you know, first building the roads and the infrastructure is needed. That's the first step. So that's why investment is the first step when the income of the country is really low. But then, you know, this is an idea that we know since Solow, basically, and Bob Solow also made the point that as you're accumulating more and more capital, you start running into diminishing returns. So as a result, growth will slow down unless growth switches to efficiency-based growth or innovation-based, technology-based growth. And this is exactly where the middle-income countries, which middle-income countries here need to make the transition. But the type of institutions that makes an economy grow in this region versus in this region is very, very different. Because initially, you know, who is going to build the roads? Who is going to build the infrastructure? Private market won't do it. You know, firms won't do it. So as a result, the government needs to put the resources together. So as a result, more, you know, centralized economies in that sense can have a comparative advantage. And many, many times when we look historically, when these countries are typically making the big push initially, we also see much more controlled economies or much more centralized economies in the beginning when you know, the infrastructure is being built. But then this gives the wrong image most of the time, because then the countries or policymakers starts to think that, well, you know, more centralized governments or more centralized economies are doing better. So as a result, this is a promising growth model and let's stick to it. And this is exactly where, you know, when they come to this transition, basically, they start, you know, slowing down significantly. Because this second part where we talk about technology and efficiency, this is exactly where we need experimentation. And this is exactly where we need entrepreneurship. This is exactly where we need ideas. And just a handful of people in a government won't come up with tomorrow's ideas, right? Especially in the days of AI, obviously, you know, we need as many experimentations as possible. We need as many minds as possible to think about where AI can be used, for instance. So that's why participation and inclusion in the society is particularly important when it comes to thinking about new ideas. So in the second phase, in the report, we argued that there has to be infusion or imitation of global ideas, as the AAZ paper also made the point. And then once countries build enough capability, then in the third stage, they can start thinking about innovation. But most of the time, again, you know, there are some standard mistakes that we observe. One of them is, you know, trying to keep the control as much as possible because it's working well in this phase. Or trying to switch too quickly to innovation phase is another mistake. You know, you're just giving a lot of R&D subsidies where the capability is not there yet. In that case, a lot of the taxpayers' money is also being wasted. So that's why this gradual step-by-step approach is really critical. And that's why, you know, first, economic decentralization, where the economic institutions need to be modified, which are more entrepreneurship-friendly and science and technology-friendly and more competition-friendly, is a different concept where, you know, most of the time, indeed, going from this phase to this phase successfully is an exception rather than a norm. Okay, so just to give you an idea, you know, there are 108 countries that are classified in the middle income phase or middle income stage, and this is roughly about six billion people. And since 1990, only 250 million people, which is, you know, if you sum them up, it's just Pakistan, basically, you know, Pakistani economy. Only that amount of people managed to graduate from middle income to high income status. So this is really an important trap that a lot of countries are falling. So now, if the productivity is really the important aspect here, what is productivity? Well, productivity, especially the aggregate productivity, is the sum of individual productivity. So if you want to think about what the productivity of this classroom is, it's effectively, you know, individual productivities combined with the amount of economic activity or our market shares, right? So say Philip is very productive. If Philip is having a very large market share, then the measured productivity will be higher. But if Philip is very high productivity and I'm very low productivity, and if I absorb the resources, in that case, the measured productivity will be lower. So even if we have the same productivity distribution, how resources are allocated across firms is a fundamental question. So that's why there's this productivity of firm I times the market share. How much room are we giving to those firms in the economy is an important question. So how much breathing room are we giving? So there were a lot of very important issues that were mentioned. Young people, young businesses, young ideas. Very, very important. Indeed, those are the fresh productive ideas, but are we giving them the breathing room? And that's exactly, I think, you know, more regulated markets are creating a problem. And so that's why, you know, there's a lot of course, discussion in Europe, especially, you know, deregulating or, you know, the need for deregulation. But I think, you know, it's important. And also today there was an, you know, very interesting talk by Simon where he also talked about regulation. But, you know, when we approach to regulation, removing everything religiously or, you know, just regulating everything religiously is not the way to go or ideologically. So we have to have a better understanding, you know, which regulations are not leaving room for new ideas to flourish, and which ideas do, which regulations do. So, of course, you know, just a simple depiction here is that, you know, if we just distribute resources equally for the same productivity distribution across firms, if we give them the same resources, then the measured productivity on the left will be lower. But if more productive firms, which are green, are getting more resources and less productive firms, the red ones, are you know, shrinking or exiting, then for the same productivity distribution, we will have higher aggregate productivity. Now, how can we measure this empirically? Well, there's already a growing literature on this. We need to look at the changes, basically. So once I become more productive from last year to this year, am I hiring more people, right? So it's changes of the productivity within firm, how it's affecting my hiring patterns. So if by becoming more productive, I hire more workers, in that case, more productive firms will have more market share, higher market share, basically. So this is just a simple, you know, change delta term that we need to measure. So that's why in this simple regression, I promised I won't show, I had promised not to show any Greek letters, but here is one. So this is firm growth is labor growth, okay? How many workers we are hiring, and here, this is the change in productivity of the firm. So this is the usual responsiveness regression. So I think historical data is important. Indeed, there's an interesting discussion of eliminating historical data in Europe. Yes?
The productivity shock, is it the change?
Change.
Or the cross-sectional difference?
It's change. Within firm, it's change.
You could think it's the level matters with the growth as well as the growth.
Sure, absolutely. So here, one thing that I want to understand here is how is a firm's market share within firm changing? So if I'm innovating, am I hiring more people? Otherwise, of course, you know, the cross-sectional part is also very, very important. And we will talk about cross-section as well. So historical records are very, very important, but I think, you know, there's a discussion ongoing, especially in Germany, of burning the historical records, which I think is very, very problematic because, you know, there's a lot to be learned from historical records. But due to, I guess the argument would be about the privacy probably, but, you know, there are ways to tackle the privacy issues. We all are working with the, you know, sensitive data. And that's why I think it would be a big mistake. But let's leave that aside. Here, we are looking at late 80s and early 90s. Why is it interesting? It's interesting because this was an episode where the economic systems were the most extreme case, right? We had market economies and we had totally controlled economies, and then there are some economies that are in between. So that's why East Germany and Soviet Russia are the fully controlled economy, where, you know, a central authority is deciding what to do. US is the fully market economy in that respect, and West Germany is somewhere in between, right? You know, having also government regulation in the market is also creating this controlled environment. So when we run this regression, no surprise there that we are getting zero coefficient for East Germany and Soviet Russia, because the notion there is resources are being distributed centrally, right? So there is no notion of becoming more innovative and then absorbing the resources. So a central authority is deciding which entity is going to innovate, which entity is going to produce. So that's why this is not a surprise. But I think the more interesting part, which is still true, by the way, so this is a historical thing, but still it is true. When we compare US to West Germany, the responsiveness is almost half of the US in West Germany, which means that for the same productivity shock, a US firm is creating significantly more jobs than European or German counterparts. So as a result, you know, what we would expect is that more productive firms should be becoming larger, and as a result, there has to be a very significant positive relationship between the two. But when we look at this picture, obviously, if deltas don't match, levels should not match either. So that's why, you know, when we look at the simple, you know, correlation between size and productivity in the US, size and productivity is significantly more correlated than in Germany. This means that the German firms are larger, not because they are more productive, but due to different reasons, basically. Okay, so, and if you, by the way, you know, it was really stunning, and very recently with Francesca and co-authors, we calculated this covariance for other countries. I thought the lowest it can get was zero, but we calculated it for South Africa, which turned out to be significantly negative. And you know, we thought there was a mistake. And after a week, after a month, we gave in, and so it's very much, you know, negatively correlated. And of course, there's a lot of legacy associated with apartheid, etc. So that's why I think it's really important to remember that, especially in developing countries or in emerging economies, there is love for larger firms, right? Because it's seen as a measure of development. Having larger firms is a measure of development. So that's why, you know, we have to have larger firms, but, you know, the largest firms were also during communist times, right? So that's why just the size itself is not sufficient. There has to be also this correlation with productivity.
On your example, how can we show that West Germany maybe needs more capital for the given productivity shock, to hire more capital, maybe labor is...
So normally in these regressions, you try to control for capital and to see for the same productivity shock if they are creating more jobs. But of course, you know, one can also be interested in looking at the capital as well. But since there's a lot of emphasis on job creation, so this should be an important aspect that we should be worried about from a policy point of view. Now, dynamism. Business dynamism in general have many different elements. Of course, you know, from Philippe's and Peter's work, we know that, you know, entry and exit is extremely fundamental, extremely important. So maybe, you know, incumbents are, you know, as you said, maybe incumbents are not responding as much, or maybe they are trying to, you know, fix the situation a different way. Let's look at the entry patterns in that case. But when we look at the entry patterns and exit patterns, again, we almost get 50% of the US when it comes to West Germany. And, you know, both from the incumbent side and from the entrant side, we see a significantly lower business dynamism in general. And I think, you know, this is an important observation which needs to be addressed. And you know, when we look at the entry rate over time, In Germany, you know, entry rate has been trending downwards both in the US and Germany. But, you know, historically, the entry rate has been lower, and even the recent data shows that entry rate is always lower. So continental Europe, or especially Germany, has never been a startup nation, right? It's been the country of large firms, large businesses. And indeed, you know, most of the, you know, largest companies in Germany were founded before 1950 today, right? Whereas in the US, it's typically over the past 30 years or so. Yes?
Just wondering, can it be the role of financial markets is very important?
Because absolutely.
In USSR, you didn't need financial markets because there was some guy in the Politburo that was saying, you get the money. Maybe in Germany you need bigger capital in order to finance the same amount and get the same shock.
It could be many different things. You know, that's definitely one possibility. Maybe another important possibility is the labor market regulations. Hiring and firing costs are very, very high. So, you know, indeed, if I know that, you know, there are a lot of fees associated with hiring or firing, it will create a hold-up problem. Even if I innovate, I will be cautious. Rather than hiring 10 people, I will hire 5 people and I'll say, let's wait and see, right? So that's why, you know, I like the example of this music instrument accordion, right? Like, you know, you expand and, shrink. So that flexibility isn't there as we know. So, you know, I think what's really important is, again, this is not going to be a surprise or new information to this crowd, but ideally we want to have a balance between creation, preservation, and destruction as we see on the right graph. But most of the time, we see from the policymakers' point of view that there's a lot of emphasis on preservation and reducing exit, especially. You know, before the COVID shock, In Europe, there was a big debate about lower interest rate and creating a lot of zombie firms and, you know, cheaper access to finance, etc. Again, the discussion was not having enough destruction, and, you know, it's primarily also, you know, policymakers not being able to make peace with the fact that, you know, some business in a health, even in a healthy economy, some businesses have to shut down. But, you know, I think by offering a lot of subsidies, indeed, from our Germany work, we, you know, I haven't put it into our slides, but, you know, what we have seen repeatedly is that whenever companies are in troubled situation, and why are they troubled? In troubled situation because they are not productive enough. But whenever they are in troubled situation, the government is extending the hand and offering additional subsidy to make them survive, basically. And of course, that's primarily kicking the can down the street. So now, this is coming from today's data, and this is German map. And when you look at income per capita in different regions, it's striking, right? So you have this light area, and then you have this dark area, and here you see this economic wall. And this is exactly where the wall was. That's exactly where the separation between East and West Germany was. When we look at patent per capita, it's even more severe, right? When it comes to innovation, you know, the things that we discussed since the morning, it's even more severe. Look at the wall here. You know, even though there has been integration, at least on paper, the economic integration has not been fully achieved. This is despite the fact, and this is, I think, a very important observation. This is despite the fact that there has been ton of money that was being spent on East Germany. Okay, so subsidy wasn't lacking at all. Indeed, maybe, you know, one can even potentially think that, you know, when it comes to the comparison between Poland and East Germany, Poland, of course, didn't have a rich brother or sister to save itself. So as a result, it was a sink or swim type of situation in the beginning. So a lot of the unproductive firms had to be shut down, and also a lot of the SOEs at the time. Whereas for East Germany, of course, you know, this was a very political situation. And, you know, there were elections upcoming in 1994. Helmut Kohl wanted to, of course, enter into election by showing that indeed East and West Germany became a single economy, single country, and Eastern workers are just living just like the Western workers. So that was the promise. You know, he promised rosy days. So in order to achieve this, there was a lot of money that was being spent. And look at the timing of the money. Indeed, just due to this mechanical convergence in the beginning, the rest of the convergence has been extremely slow. And today, even today, the productivity gap between East and West Germany is more than 20%, despite the fact that there was massive money that's being spent, both back then and afterwards.
So Poland also received a lot of money after this period from Europe, and that corresponds to the period of very fast growth. So do you think that the money was better spent?
So, there's no doubt, of course, there were multiple things in place, but there was this shock therapy in Poland at the time, and you know, the transition in Poland has been much more painful at the time than East Germany, so that's why, you know, because of the lack of resources, I mean, all these economies, of course, received resources, but the way Poland approach also privatization was very different than East Germany. For instance, again, because of the political pressure, there was a massive push for ending the privatization before 1994. They were so, you know, not equipped sufficiently. What did they do? In order to privatize the economy, there were 15,000 companies in East Germany to be privatized, and there were only 200 agents in privatization agency to handle 15,000 privatization cases. What did they do? They sent letters or phone calls to West German companies, asked them to send their managers to run the privatization process. So effectively, in Turkish, we say you give a ship to the wolf, basically. And so many things went also wrong with the privatization process too. Whereas in Poland, they took their time, and, you know, the privatization primarily started significantly later compared to East Germany. So the dynamics were substantially different. So now, again, there are many, many different studies behind behind these observations. But I think, you know, an interesting question here is that the wall fell. Why did the economic divide remain? And the full convergence has not been achieved despite large transfers, same institutions, still a major productivity and innovation gap. You saw the innovation gap, especially. It's, you know, one side is doing the innovation, the other side is completely silent when it comes to new technology creation. And so I think, you know, one thing that I will argue is that the capability aspect has not been focused. You know, just giving money is not enough. There's an important capability aspect that was missed, and so I will argue that. So now, these are, you know, these are two products from East and West Germany. You know, the infamous Trabant. If you haven't seen it, you should see it in the museum. There are two Trabants parked in front of the Spy Museum in Berlin. So in case you're interested, the Spy Museum is also super interesting, by the way. So this is the typical product of East Germany, and that's the typical product of the West Germany from that time. And then suddenly you ask these type of companies to compete with each other. Of course, you know, when you ask this type of competition, well, you know, competition is good. But at the same time, you know, one has to really think about if the goal is really to keep these players somehow, you know, in the market by becoming more productive. Probably, you know, we should have a broader picture, basically. And we know, for instance, again, from Philips and Peter's work with on the 2001 paper of step-by-step competition. Where you are in the race has an important effect on your or on your incentives. And what we see from the historical data is that within the same product categories, when we compare the prices between East and West products, they were significantly in favor of Western products, which means that the West German companies within the same product category were charging significantly higher price than East German products, which, you know, mostly reflect the quality difference between the two sides. So there has been a significant quality gap, and over time that quality gap has remained. So normally you would expect some convergence to take place, but it looks like the competition didn't really lift the East German company qualities or product qualities. And as a result, this you know, quality difference has remained the same way. Now, you know, how should we interpret this quality gap? And we know from these general equilibrium models, and we've seen several of them throughout the conference today, there are many, many moving parts that's taking place in these models, right? And depending on what the mechanism is, the policy recommendation is completely different. For instance, you know, if it's discouragement effect, for instance, you know, if the companies are being discouraged, and you know, I'm too unproductive and I don't have any incentive, the type of policies that you might want to implement is very different. Then it's not about the quality of the product, but it's about my ability to innovate. It's very different. So if you give me money, what I will deliver in return is very different in the two scenarios, right? So the observation is the same. Innovation doesn't take place, but in one of them it's due to incentives. In the other case, it's due to inability to innovate. And it's very important to understand what's going on. So that's why, you know, we built these, you know, general equilibrium models in order to discipline, you know, how strong is the discouragement effect and how important is the innovation capability aspect. And, you know, one thing that I would like to show you is that look at the R&D to GDP ratio. Look at the R&D to GDP ratio. In the West, R&D to GDP ratio, the red line, keeps just increasing. Whereas when you look at the East German private R&D to GDP ratio, the yellow line, there is no increase in R&D spending. So somehow whatever policy was being implemented or whatever policies were implemented at the time, they could not achieve more R&D hunger by the firms. Okay, so that's why, you know, just finding the budget and giving them the money in any way doesn't cut it necessarily, right? So we need to really understand, you know, why in terms of innovation, things are getting even worse. Look at the, you know, West German private companies, East German private companies, and look at the gap. The gap is just widening, despite the fact that there has been a lot of subsidies that's been offered. So that's why I think it's really important to understand why the gap is just opening up rather than, you know, converging. And when we look at the discouragement effect, of course, when you have an estimated structural model, you can shut down certain channels. And, you know, this is what's happening in the background, and I'm avoiding all those mathematical details. But what we see is that, of course, you know, there has been some discouragement effect for sure, okay? Indeed, if you eliminate the discouragement effect, then we see some faster convergence. The red line is the counterfactual scenario where what if the East German firms were not discouraged by what happened and were incentivized as if they were neck and neck with West German firms. Then you see this convergence, but then there's still a big gap, unexplained gap, and that unexplained gap is particularly coming from the ability difference or capability difference. Now, imagine an economy where you have higher quality West German firms and lower quality East German firms. One thing one can do is that, hey, I'm going to make East German firms license the technology of West German firms, so as a result, the quality gap can close right from the beginning. That's the yellow line. So what if the German government at the time, rather than saying, look, I'm going to subsidize you to create more jobs, the German government said, hey, I'm going to use the taxpayers' money for East German firms to license technology from West German firms, compulsory licensing, okay? In that case, you see this massive jump in the quality gap, but then there's a significant worsening over time. So even if you bring me to the same knowledge level or same quality level, how things will continue from that point on depends on my ability and my competitors' ability in generating new ideas. That's what I mean by capability difference.
So, I was thinking of the Skoda. Skoda is a success story, more or less. Maybe I was biased. I was in Czech Republic last week. So, but they merged. Skoda, I think, merged with the Volkswagen or BMW. And that's a success story. It looks like it worked better.
But maybe it would have been a better it would have been a better success story if it was merged with BYD. Rather than. So we'll see in 10 years.
Why work in the Czech case?
Yeah. No, it would be interesting for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So now, here's another, you know, to me, of course, you know, it's a very interesting result. You now ask the following question. What if I subsidize R&D in the East and I use the same amount of money to subsidize West German companies instead of East German companies? What would be the welfare consequence of this on East German consumers or East German economy in general? And that result is very interesting. Again, same amount of money. We are using same amount of money. In one case, we are subsidizing West German firms. In one case, we are subsidizing East German firms. Look at what's happening here. In the long run, subsidizing West German firms has a higher welfare consequence on the East than subsidizing direct Eastern firms. Why? So that's exactly because of the capability difference, right? So there is, you know, cost of conducting R&D in the East is 3.5 times higher than the West. So that's why, you know, even if you just give them the money, unless they have the same capability, they will always fall behind. They will, it's just like these, you know, clocks or watches, you know, that are not able to keep up because there is the engine, the innovation engine is not working as effectively. So that's why, you know, just rather than extending R&D subsidy or just rather than just licensing technologies, I think there's a very important element, which is the ecosystem. Innovation ecosystem, innovation capability is a very important aspect.
Is there an element that, you know, from East Germany, the best scientists, whatever, migrated to
yes.
the West.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Maybe,
yes.
that may be a difference with the Czech.
Very good.
Much less migration away from Czech.
Absolutely. Very good point, Philip. That's exactly one of the main problems, actually. That's exactly one of the main problems. And I'll come to that in a second. Because ultimately, we have to ask ourselves, you know, what is this capability difference? No. And it's, of course, the individuals, right? You know, it's the ecosystem, and in that ecosystem, the talent, you know, there were many emphasis on talent, and talent that's, you know, that's so hard to grow over time. You know, once you lose that talent, of course, it has a huge impact on the capability. Now, of course, yes, please. So no, this is I think this is an excellent question. Can I come back to this once, you know, indeed I would like to leave some time for discussion, and that's a fantastic question to discuss. And I think there's an important lesson to be learned, because ultimately, you know, the fact that subsidizing West Germany makes East Germany better is an important message. You know, that's why, you know, there are these innovation hubs in the US, right? You know, we don't have evenly distributed innovation centers in the US, right? We always talk about California and Silicon Valley. We talk about Route 128. And, you know, we talk about these centers because there's a lot of agglomeration that's associated with innovation, right? You know, why are we all in this room rather than us individually working? Because, you know, the synergy, the, you know, bringing resources. There was an, you know, fantastic emphasis on assortative matching of resources, for instance, ability. It's so critical when it comes to idea generation. Standard assembly line production is a different thing than technology and idea generation and innovation. So that's why I think, you know, how to design that ecosystem is very, very different. So that's why, you know, concentrating resources is very important, as we see in the US. But that's a very challenging task to do it in Europe. You know, which country will the resources be concentrated? So, and that's why, you know, I think that's a very interesting debate, which I would love to hear also, you know, others' opinion on this. Of course, you know, there are ways to spread the effort, but at the same time, agglomeration is also very, very critical. Like, think about the German case. You know, I'm very familiar with the German case, so that's why I think it's a fascinating example. You know, when you think about departments, like in the US, for instance, which econ departments are you know, where should you go to meet people? You know the places, right? You know, this is university, that university. They are very concentrated. In Germany, you know, you have two, three person in this university in Bonn, two, three people in Frankfurt, in Mannheim. It's very dispersed. And on top of this, there are all these research centers too, right? So the resources are very much distributed. It's not concentrated. It's a different model. So I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, that model cannot be improved. But at the same time, you know, it's probably the wrong idea also to try to replicate the US system in Europe in that case. So if there are certain peculiarities to the European system, then the design should be improved accordingly. Because, you know, it's impossible to bring the same level of concentration in Europe compared to the US, in my opinion. But, you know, I'm happy to discuss this more. Now, I think the idea of creative destruction is very appealing to all of us, of course, but implementing this from a policy-making point of view is very, very difficult. Here's one example. So, of course, you know, when the wall came down, a lot of companies were being privatized, and the privatization agency was blamed for what was going on, right? The unemployment rate effectively went from 0% to 30%, you know, 15%. If you include also the underemployment, then it, you know, some people say 30%, 40%, etc. And then people start to protest on the street. And of course, whenever, you know, people start protesting, this creates a big stress on policymakers. especially when there are upcoming elections. But on top of this, the head of the privatization agency in April 1st, 1991 got assassinated and he died. Okay, so then imagine the pressure on policymakers and also the privatization agency. So what did they do after April 1st, 1991? They changed their privatization strategy completely. So, and I think this is a very creative destruction story, in my opinion. Maybe I'm just seeing the world that's creative destruction, but you know, with the creative destruction glasses. So these are the privatization contracts, and the red bars are showing the privatization contracts that were issued based on the price. So there was due diligence that was being made on each case, and then they were asking the monetary price, basically. After the assassination, which is the dashed line there, after the assassination, the policy changes completely, and then you know the privatization agency stops asking for monetary price, but primarily combines these privatization cases with labor commitments. They say, hey, Kiar, I'm going to sell this company to you, but you have to have 10,000 workers in this company, and I'm going to come and audit you. Or, you know, John, I'm going to sell this company to you, you have to have 5,000 workers or 20,000 workers. So these are the dark shaded ones. And as you can see, there's a departure between the two types of contracts. So now what happened? What happened? So there was this commitment, labor commitment, and then there was also the realized one. So I'm privatizing the company and I say, look, in 3 years, you have to have 10,000 workers. And in 3 years, now as an econometrician, we can see the realization, okay? So that's why on the x-axis, now we will look at the realized minus commitment, which means that if I satisfied the commitment, I have to be on the positive side. If I failed to meet the commitment, then I need to be on the negative side. And there was a punishment associated with each deviation, basically. So for each worker that I cannot meet, I had to pay a significant fine. So how did this distribution look like in the data? This is exactly how it looked like. Okay, so there was a very significant bunching. Indeed, 25% of the firms just tried to push themselves above the commitment level. And when you look at the employment growth, so on the x-axis this time, it's the initial size divided by the final target. So when I was privatizing this company, what was the size initially of this company and what was the target? So initially, if I was 5,000 workers and then the commitment tells me that I have to be 10,000 workers, the ratio is 0.5 and I'm here. Okay. So this means that if I'm less than one, I was below the commitment target. If I'm above, I was already above the commitment target. What happened after this policy? Well, there was massive growth. A lot of jobs were created. Indeed, the firms that were subject to these labor commitments grew by 30%. Imagine how unproductive those firms were. Indeed, many of those firms, I'm sure you must have also spoken to many people who might have visited those factory sites. The productivity gap was just massive. And despite that, despite the low productivity, because of the political pressure, those firms were forced to hire more people. So this is exactly 180 degree opposite of creative destruction, right? It's really kicking the can down the street. And then, of course, what happens ultimately is that, you know, here, this is just a policy simulation where in the pink area, this is the policy period, basically, when you have labor commitment. The firms are growing, the red line, but as soon as the policy period is over, the commitment period is over, all those jobs that have been created is being lost. So by the way, labor commitment was associated with punishment for not growing, but a similar policy is subsidy. So rather than punishing a firm for being small, if you subsidize firm for growing, it has the same mathematical impact, basically. So as a result, you know, the R&D, not R&D subsidy, the employment subsidies are serving the same purpose, basically. So if government is providing a subsidy for creating more jobs, yes, they will create more jobs during that time. Indeed, in the paper, we are showing that there's a one-to-one mapping between labor commitments and a subsidy policy. And but as soon as that the subsidy is over, all those jobs will be lost. So a more organic job creation in the long term, sustainable job creation, is by improving the productivity of these firms. So that's why I think, you know, it's really important to think. Indeed, John also mentioned this in his presentation. When you look at these, you know, productivity-based policies, the employment numbers will increase significantly slowly compared to a direct subsidy, because technology takes time to build, innovate, etc. But then in the long term, the technology-based policies are keeping the employment numbers organically higher. Okay, so that's why I think it's important to differentiate between the two. Just in 2 minutes, I would like to just also mention also what Philippe had mentioned earlier. So Philippe, you mentioned the scientist leaving. So the left graph is here showing exactly the migration patterns. Okay, and on the x-axis, we have the AKM fixed effects estimated for individuals, and more productive people, including scientists, were indeed leaving East Germany significantly. The overall migration, out-migration numbers were significantly higher, but the pattern was also heterogeneous, especially towards more productive people. So that's why I think, you know, and, you know, when you also look at, for instance, who becomes a manager in the German data, there's a very significant relationship between, you know, AKM fixed effect and the manager share of that group. And there were, you know, scientists, managers, high-skilled people that were being lost to West Germany in general. So there has been a significant negative selection in that regard. The final thing I would like to mention is that, of course, you know, the government also tried to intervene on the innovation side, both by allocating more fund, you know, more money, especially to universities. So that's why, you know, when you look at the university outputs, East and West Germany by field, they are producing almost the same number of papers. So universities, the green bars are showing by field the ratio of papers that are being written in the East and West. And remarkably, the ratio is almost equal to one. By the way, the highest salaries in the East are teachers and professors on average. So the government, through these state entities, is keeping the salaries up, and it's keeping the science up. But when you look at the patenting by firms, you see, apart from those three fields, fishing, crop farming, etc., in all other fields, you know, East Germany is significantly dominated by West. Okay, so this means that, you know, innovation is still, you know, even though the socialist episode is over, but still the government is trying to do the innovation itself rather than market. So they couldn't create this happy marriage between market and the state entities. And I think this is another important lesson, that, you know, just spending money is not enough. There has to be this organic merger between market forces and the state in public money, but it hasn't been achieved. So let me stop here. In the remaining few minutes, we can discuss the questions, but, you know, let me not go through this, but you already so the main message, I think, you know, rather than just thinking about creating more, we have to look at the composition, and we have to also, you know, think about the capability aspect. It's not only about the technology gap, but it's not only bringing the technologies to the same level, but we have to also think about the deltas, basically. From that point on, do I have the capability to push the technology frontier forward? And that's exactly where the ecosystem comes into play. And thank you. Thanks.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.